Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Today on Change Surfer Radio, I'm speaking with Marshall Brain. He's the inventor of the How Stuff Works website and series of books, and he's recently had an epiphany that robotics will lead to massive unemployment and require a complete restructuring of our welfare system. Stay tuned for that. I'm speaking today with Marshall Brain. He's a computer scientist and entrepreneur, the founder of the How Stuff Works website and series of books and related enterprises. Welcome, Mr. Brain.
Hey, how are you doing today?
We're going to talk in a second about your epiphany about the effects of automation on the economy, but I want to start by laying down your credentials, which are very interesting for someone to come to the conclusions that you have. You started as a computer scientist. You were teaching at North Carolina State, is that it?
Yes.
And what kind of computer science did you do? Were you involved in robotics at the time?
No, I actually have a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering and computer engineering, and then moved to computer science for my master's degree. And I was teaching undergraduates, but the interesting thing about teaching undergraduates is that their minds go in a million different directions, and that's what makes that kind of teaching so much fun. So I've taught just about every undergraduate computer science course you can imagine.
Then you bagged out of that in about 1992, and you started a software training company. Is that right? You became an entrepreneur.
That's true. I had written a book on motif programming, actually, a graphical system for Unix computers, and that gave me the opportunity to start a consulting company. And did a lot of training on Wall Street and in other large corporations as people were moving over to Unix systems.
Then How Stuff Works, how did that come about?
That was an accident. I had written about 10 books, and I just wanted to try something different. So the really nice thing about publishing on the web is that you can do it incrementally. You can just write one article and publish it and get feedback on it and write another one. And so How Stuff Works, I was doing strictly for the fun of it. I just enjoyed working on the articles, and I'd do about one or two a week, mostly on weekends, and just throw them up on a little website my wife and I had. And it just, once it hit about 20 articles, it just started to take off. And today there's millions of people who visit it every month, and they read about 40 million pages every month. It's just been a real long upward rise in traffic ever since the first couple weeks I started it.
And do you write it all, or are other people figuring out how stuff works as well?
There's about 20 people that work for the company, and we have a big pool of freelance writers as well. So there's thousands of topics that are dealt with. It'd be hard for me to have written all of that, but I have read all of it, so I have a pretty broad base of knowledge about how things work.
Well, that's a fascinating way to start into this topic of how the economy is going to be changed by technology, because you've kind of looked at how everything is getting made in the first place, and it must help you work backwards to what the conclusions might be.
Well, it's interesting, actually, to have really broad knowledge of how all these different things work and how they fit together, and to have had the opportunity to look at all these different things, technology and social things, and really be able to get into them and understand them at some level. That's been a great opportunity.
Now, you have put up a website that you can find at marshallbrain.com, a website about your robotic nation epiphany. Tell us how you came to this epiphany about what the effects of automation were going to be on our society.
Well, it started with a short story about a system that could be created that would manage minimum wage workers that are working in places like fast food restaurants and convenience stores and large retail stores. And the system is called Mana in the short story that I had written. And it's It's just a computerized system that manages people using headphones, and it can keep track of where they are in the store and tell them what to do and get responses from them and so on. And that short story really got me thinking about not only about kind of where we're headed in the management of people, but also what happens as robots start to get integrated into that. Because, you know, anybody, I think, with a computer science background is familiar with how quickly computers are gaining more and more capability, more and more CPU power and memory and so on. And, you know, just a real simple extrapolation of where we have been and where we are now and where we will be gets you to the point where you can see computers having the same processing power as the human brain somewhere in a 2040 time frame. I've seen things as early as 2030, and maybe it takes till 2050, but somewhere around in the 2040 time frame, computers and human brains have about equal capacity. And you just start to look at what that means, and then you look at how many jobs there are in the economy that are manageable by computer and then replaceable by robots, and our economy, in my opinion, just isn't set up to handle that kind of situation. So, you know, it was a process of thinking and then reading and studying and playing with the idea that got the whole writing process started for me. And then I just decided to put it together in a set of articles and put it out on the web to see what other people were thinking.
Now, there are a lot of pessimists about artificial intelligence. There's been a lot of hype over the years and a lot of raised expectations. People thought we would have HAL by this time. But you think that these problems like robotic speech, robotic vision, expert systems will fall by the wayside as Moore's Law kicks in and the computing power kicks in. Is that the basic gist of it?
Yes. You can see the same process in chess-playing computers. As far back as 1950, people had been predicting that computers would beat humans in chess, and it didn't happen in 1960 or in 1970 or in 1980, and that's simply because there wasn't the computing power available. So those predictions were a little optimistic in 1950, but eventually computers did start to beat human beings in chess, and now computers can beat nearly everyone in chess, and it's just a function of computer power. So as we get up to parity with the human brain, the same kind of stuff's going to happen with vision processing, with speech understanding, and it's just a matter of time to let the hardware catch up with the brain's power.
So you go through in your in the essays that you have up on the web, Robotic Nation being the first of those, you go through the various parts of the economy, the various kinds of work in the economy that will be affected, and basically it's everything. Obviously, manufacturing has been profoundly affected by automation over the years, but tell us how, for instance, management. I mean, this seems like people have said for a long time that the white-collar occupations, the service occupations, the intellectual occupations wouldn't be affected by roboticization because you couldn't make a computer that was sophisticated enough to take over those jobs.
Well, there's two big areas that haven't been affected by automation yet, and one of them is white-collar, and the other is the service sector. So if you look at how a restaurant works today or a retail store or a construction site, there really is no difference between now and, say, 1950. You know, in 1950, it was a guy with a circular saw and a hammer on the construction site. Now it's a guy with a circular saw and a nail gun. There really has been no progress at all. Manufacturing, as you said, has been totally changed by automation, but these other two parts of the economy haven't. So in MANA, the concept is that any job that can be broken down into a series of tasks can be managed easily by a computer because the computer just has to walk through the task lists and assign them to people to do. And lots of jobs are easily broken down into task lists like that. So, you know, not only will we see computers taking over management jobs, but right now we're seeing the offshoring of management and other white-collar jobs to much lower-paying parts of the world. So you know, it'll be a combination not only of computer technology, but also this kind of global outsourcing that affects white-collar jobs in America. And then the service sector, you know, you just look at the economy's been creating millions and millions of low-paying service sector jobs for the last 40 years or so in places like fast food restaurants and retail stores. And those jobs are perfect for replacement by robot. And so you've got at least half of the workers in America working in jobs that are all going to become obsolete and roboticized at approximately the same time. And that churn that's going to occur when that starts to happen just have a profound effect on the way we think about work, the economy as a whole. It'll be a remarkable period of time.
Don't know if you're aware of the document Triple Revolution. It was written back in 1964 by a bunch of economists, Robert Heilbronner and a bunch of other activists at the time. They wrote it to President Johnson, and one of the things that they said was that automation would create structural unemployment in America and urged a basic income framework. But in the response to that piece in the next year in the New York Review of Books, Daniel Bell said that the thing that they forgot to look at was whether automation was affecting all the different sectors of the economy. And if it wasn't, then this wouldn't come about because people just shift around. And that the way to tell if automation was going to create structural unemployment is if you had rising productivity and falling employment. And what do we have now?
We have rising productivity, falling employment. And the other thing is we have this remarkable concentration of wealth occurring. So in the past, when productivity gains hit factories and so on, workers' wages or went up or their hours went down. And now we don't see that happening anymore. We have rising productivity and falling wages in a lot of cases. So it's just a remarkable thing that's happening economically to the majority of people who are participating in the economy. And they're doing it largely without complaint right now.
I mean, does anyone respond to your scenario by saying, well, there are still going to be things that robots can't do, like poetry or, you know, being a preacher or something like that? I mean, it doesn't seem like there's very much that robots won't be able to do given sufficient amount of processing power.
It's definitely the case that, you know, in 2040 or so, we'll hit parity with the human brain. But then you start to look out beyond that, and you look at 2060 and then 2080 and 2100. At that point, you have something like the power of a million human brains in a desktop machine for $1,000. And you just think of what kind of profound effect that's going to have. You know, the relationship between humans and machines in just that short period of time will change so much, and it's almost impossible to predict everything that'll happen over the next century. What we saw happen, you know, in the 20th century will seem fairly mild compared to what we're going to have coming down the road here.
I'm speaking to Marshall Brain. He's the founder of How Stuff Works, an entrepreneur, computer scientist, and a man who has been struck on the road to Tarsus by a vision. Now, your next part of your vision, you have your three essays up on the web at marshallbrain.com, Robot Nation, Robots in 2015, which is the kind of proximate effects of robotization, and then Robot Freedom. That Robot Freedom essay is about how you think our economy and our political structures need to be restructured. You think we need to have a basic universal income of about 25 grand a year. How did you come to that figure?
Well, that figure is a figure that's used a lot right now by people who are working to change the minimum wage. So we have a minimum wage that hasn't changed since 1997 because of, you know, primarily because of the concentration of wealth that's occurring. And even if it changes a little bit, you know, it might go up to $6 instead of $5.15 or something like that. That just doesn't even begin to cover the cost of living in American society. So if you read, you know, reports and so on that are being written by people who are studying the minimum wage, you really need something around $12 to $13 an hour in order to live life in American society. And you know, that works out to about $25,000 a year. So that I consider to be sort of a starting point.
I'm sure the people say to you, isn't that unrealistic when people despise welfare, that you would want to create a universal basic income, just give everybody money for nothing? Do you think that there'll be a wrenching adjustment, or will things just become patently obvious to us all?
Well, it could go a couple of different ways. That's what's so interesting about American society anyway, is that people actually have some control over the direction society moves in. So when you think about, you know, a basic wage, or you could call this a stipend as well, just the idea of that seems a little bit radical right now. But right now we're at the beginning of the first jobless recovery, or we're coming out of a recession, and really jobs aren't keeping pace with the acceleration of the economy. Well, you look 10 years out, where you don't just have a jobless recovery, you have a massive unemployment recovery, where the economy is moving up but employment is moving down, and you have more and more people in a really untenable situation where they can't find work. And one of two things is going to happen. Either they're going to get warehoused in government welfare dormitories, which is going to be approximately a form of prison, or they're going to demand a structural change in the economy and have the political power still to make something like that happen. And I would prefer to see us go in that latter direction.
Why do you think that the robotic economy will be more concentrated in wealth? Obviously, some people who lose their jobs and lose their sources of income will be poorer, but why wouldn't there be a kind of churning in the rest of the economy, the employed economy?
For me, the thing that is so striking is that this is going to happen so quickly. We're going to come over kind of a threshold where computer vision gets very easy, and as soon as that happens, the number of jobs that are going to be targeted by robotics and the breadth of that targeting is going to happen so quickly that even if the economy were going to adjust and figure out a way to reemploy all of these tens of millions of people, it's just not going to happen instantaneously. And as we saw in the last recession, when you start taking just millions of people out of their jobs, it has this effect on the entire economy that takes it down a notch as well. So you get this downward spiral in a recession. Well, now you start to look at that with far more people, and it's going to be good for no one. It's, you know, it's not going to be good for employees, obviously, but it's also not going to be good for the businesses, because they're going to see the pool of consumers decreasing. So it's just a very uncomfortable period of time that we're headed for, simply because of the speed of the change that we're going to see taking place.
One of the things that leftists often say about Keynesian economics and the welfare state is that it saved capitalism. And it's hard to imagine a capitalist system if half the economy suddenly was unable to buy anything.
That's true. That's why we need to think about it. And that's really the reason why I wrote these articles, was just to prompt people to start thinking about what's coming. This is a little bit off our radar right now. The jobless recovery is really the very first inkling we have that this is on its way. It's the kind of very leading edge of the robotic revolution. 10 years from now, we're going to be starting into the main wave of the robotic revolution, and it's going to be much harder then to control it. So if we, as a rational people, actually started to sit down and think about this, I think we would realize that capitalism does need a very strong, large pool of consumers for it to work, and we would figure out a way to make that happen.
What I really like about your approach to this is that instead of having a free marketeer approach on the one hand, which says, well, if everybody just invests in the stock market, then they'll all ride that boom, and, well, everybody will be fine, you know, everything will be okay. Or the Luddites, who I'm sure will respond now and in the future increasingly, that we need to stop this roboticization because people are going to lose their jobs. You say, look, let's have the prosperity that comes from automation and from increasing amounts of computer power, but let's redistribute it.
It's, you know, the robotic revolution is a fantastic thing. It's, going to take jobs that really are beneath the level of human dignity and eliminate them. So, you know, things like scrubbing bathrooms and flipping hamburgers and things like that, that's not really, you know, it doesn't really match up with the potential of a human being to be sitting there scrubbing out toilets. So we give that job to robots. That, as far as I'm concerned, that's a great thing. It's a move forward for the human race. But if that happens, and at the same time all the wealth concentrates into a smaller and smaller group of people so that, you know, 20% of the population is living like royalty and the other 80% is starving to death, then we haven't accomplished anything. All I think we should do is we should spread the benefits of the robots across the entire population and let all of us partake in the productivity gains and the lessening of labor and all of that that they bring. Let all of us participate in the goodness of the robotic revolution.
I'm Dr. J. This is Change Surfer Radio. You're listening to an interview with Marshall Brain. He's the founder of How Stuff Works, and he's the writer of a series of articles called Robotic Nation and Robotic Freedom about the effects of automation on the economy. Marshall, one of the things people, I'm sure, say to you about this is how are we going to pay for it, especially if people are losing their jobs and so forth. You have a whole list of creative suggestions of ways to pay for it, in addition to progressive taxation of this increasing concentration of wealth. For instance, you talk about corporate fines. You talk about selling natural resources. Tell us what's happening in Alaska, because Alaska seems to be have already adopted this idea in a small way.
They have. What I propose in my article is that we simply create a central account, and we find different streams of revenue to feed into that account, and then that account pays out equally to every American citizen. So in Alaska, what they have is the Alaska Permanent Fund, and that was funded originally by the wealth that comes from oil resources in Alaska. So they put a large sum of money into this account, and today, 20 or so years later, last year paid out about $1,500 to each citizen in Alaska, and that includes, you know, men, women, and children. So if you are a family of four, you received about $6,000 last year from the Alaska Permanent Fund for free. Not, you didn't have to do anything. Just for being a resident of the state, you received this money. So the system is already in place in Alaska, and it works. It distributes money to all the citizens, and it certainly is beneficial to the economy because all of those citizens then go out and purchase things with the money that they've received. It's a lot like a tax rebate. You know, we give tax rebates. President Bush enjoys doing this, and the idea is to stimulate and grow the economy. People take their tax rebate checks and they spend them. So we create a central account. We can fund it in a wide variety of ways. I list 9 different ways on the website, and if we think about it creatively, we can come up with dozens more. And then we send that money to consumers who will then go and spend it in the economy. So one name you could give this is turbo capitalism. Simply by giving consumers more money, we accelerate the growth of the economy. And we also stabilize the growth of the economy, because if everybody knows that they're receiving income, then they also know that they can spend that income. And that really takes a lot of the up and down cycling that we see in today's economy away.
One of the things I really liked about your essay was that although many people, certainly a lot of people on the right, think that welfare dependency robs people of creativity and their meaning of life, and I meet people on the left who think that as well, people who think that people ennoble themselves or create themselves through labor, and if everyone had an income guaranteed by the government, that we would all just be slouches. But you point to J.K. Rowling, who wrote the Harry Potter series, as an example of someone who was tremendously creative on the dole.
Yes, she was sitting on top of a $1 billion idea. You know, the Harry Potter series has sold tens of millions of books and has had its movies and so on, but she was on welfare when she wrote it. And that's, you know, if you think about it, that's just unbelievable. And you think of how many people in our economy are working two minimum wage jobs or, you know, doing whatever they're doing instead of doing what they really would like to be doing or what they're best at doing, simply so that they can put food on the table so they don't starve to death. It's, you know, it's really a kind of funny way to design the economy. And, you know, the other, just to take your idea a little bit further, another really common comment that comes in is that we'll create a nation of alcoholics and deadbeats if we start giving people a guaranteed source of income. And the obvious response to that is that we have all sorts of ways that we give money to people now, and that doesn't happen. But just, you know, I would say to the audience, in your own personal life, if you had the freedom that, let's say, $25,000 a year would give you, you know, what would you do differently with your life? How would you spend your time? How would you invest your time? What sort of things might you do that you're unable to do right now in a creative realm? You know, just think about how differently you would look at life, your life in particular, and the life of your friends and family, if there was not this need to work 60 hours a week just to pay for food and housing. And I really think it would transform our society in ways we can't even imagine. And the place I'm exploring that transformation is in these short stories under the title of Manna. It's actually becoming like a mini novel that I'm publishing on the web. So kind of explore how society would change first as the robots come, and then if we were to have a guaranteed source of income for the citizens of the United States or the world.
That's at marshallbrain.com. That's Marshall with two L's. And I really want to thank you for coming on today. And tell us, what else are you going to do? You've got a blog up on at marshallbrain.com. You've got the essays. You've got the Manna that you're publishing there. Are you planning to put out a book? Are you planning to try to, you know, start a mini movement? I mean, where are you going with this?
I would love to see this resonate and to see people understand how vulnerable really we all are in the way the economy is designed today, and start thinking about different ways to design the economy as robots come and transform it. The next thing I'll be publishing is a set of economic thought questions that kind of come at this from different angles. So those will start to come out over the next couple weeks. I'll finish off the Manna book. But if there's people in the audience who are interested in getting started making this a reality, I would invite you to read the articles, and then my contact information is available at marshallbrain.com.
I've been speaking with Marshall Brain. He's the founder of the How Stuff Works website. He's a computer scientist and entrepreneur, and the author of the Robotic Nation series that's up on his website at marshallbrain.com, where you can read his blog and all about the effects of automation on our economy. Thanks so much for being with us today.
I really appreciate it. You have a good weekend.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.